So what have we learned? That a delusion is an idea. That an idea can be contagious. That human beings are pattern-seeking animals. By which I mean we prefer ideas that fit a pattern. In other words, we don't believe what we see. We see what we believe. And when we are stressed, or our beliefs are challenged, when we feel threatened, the ideas we have can become irrational. One delusion leading to another, and another, as the human mind struggles to maintain its identity. And when this occurs, what starts as an egg can become a monster.
I'm sure many of you recognize the omniscient narrator from Legion. His various clips played here often, and part of a theme I've explored since civilization broke down in utter madness last year. The show Legion is about mental disease, collective and personal. Just as at its core, the Nag Hammadi Library is about mental disease too, personal and collective. Yet the Nag Hammadi Library and other Gnostic Gospels go further and deal with cosmic mental disease. Like Stephen Davis said in my book, Voices of Gnosticism, the Gnostic story is simple. God went crazy and became us.
Look how he spends his time. 43 species of parrots. Nipples for men. Slugs. Slugs! He created slugs. They can't hear, they can't speak, they can't operate machinery. I mean, are we not in the hands of a lunatic?
Yet in this Philip K. Dick world, this surveillance magician state, where the infectious empire is more deranged than ever, they have switched contexts and definitions to the point Orwell is turning in his Fabian grave. As Evelyn Underhill once said, sanity consists in sharing the hallucinations of our neighbors. And as C.G. Jung said, show me a sane man and I'll cure him.
Do you know what crazy is? Crazy is majority rules. Yeah,
You freaks and outcasts, you of the broken places, you high priests and priestesses of Sophia and Hermes, see through all of this double speak and see the collapsing of lucidity across the nations. You've lost your mind, but come to your senses. As Caitlin Johnstone wrote, the only thing keeping the world from plunging into total insanity are those few who are insane enough to doubt its sanity. And as Robert Anton Wilson said, of course I'm crazy, but that doesn't mean I'm wrong.
Sell crazy someplace else. We're all stocked up here.
You know about the themes we've been covering at Aeon Byte. What you should know is that I included the summary of the omniscient narrator of Legion, John Hamm, because this show is our 15-year anniversary. You heard it, 15 years. Even if in truth, I really didn't go full-time until late in 2018. Pushed by a crisis and spirits who beckoned me to rise higher into the stratospheres of heresy. Regardless, I've been doing this for 15 years. Ever since Robert Price was my first guest in the spring of 2006. And here we are at the end of a world of reason and sound thought. With the Joker and the Thief, wondering if there is some way out of here. I think you know we do have a way out. and we have learned together here at the Virtual Alexandria.
To quote the great Joseph Campbell, he said, it is by going down into the abyss where we recover the treasures of life. Where you stumble, there lies your treasure. To the ironic twist of the unknown.
Thus, in this special show, we will be dealing with the curing of madness from a collective, personal, and cosmic stance. For this, we have the honor of having Monty Oxymoron, keyboard player for the legendary punk band The Damned. He will be discussing his new book, The Cosmic Brain Explodes. You could say this speculative and autobiographical book is Monty's coming out of the Gnostic closet, his gospel and his myth, a radioactive Gnostic / Hermetic expression, but also a perceptive work exploring the fragmented human psyche and how to heal it with both alternative and spiritual methods. Welcome, Monty, to this Age of Hermes. And we need more Knights of Valis in this Black Iron Arkham Asylum. I mean, Yaldibaldi is only getting hornier and making us all the inmates from the movie Sucker Punch, or the poor FBI chick agent from Alan Moore's Necronomicon.
They have created a repressive society, and we are their unwitting accomplices. Their intention to rule rests with the annihilation of consciousness. We have been lulled into a trance. They have made us indifferent to ourselves, to others. We are focused only on our own gain.
And perhaps the Demiurge is the cause of all of this. The great mind parasite infecting humanity for ages, bringing us to our knees while he feeds off our divinity, as in the Gnostic myths. I read Grant Morrison's Nameless early this spring, a wonderful Gnostic nightmare. I like this passage. Now, consider the possibility that we've always had a disembodied alien life form living among us, invisible yet able to occupy minds and alter them. It hides in plain sight, everywhere. The mind boasts of its own omnipotence. It informs us that we are no more than submissive instruments of its will. Then deliberately wills us to defy its rules? All the while, it vows to punish every preordained breach of those rules, however brief or minor, with eternal, agonizing torture in a cosmic concentration camp. What name might we give such an omnipresent evil? The answer is God. You're talking about God.
Oh, you like to think you're a god. You're not a god. You're just a parasite, eaten out with jealousy and envy and longing for the lives of others. You feed on them, on the memory of love and loss and birth and death and joy and sorrow. So, come on then, take mine.
For all Aeon Byte listeners, you know how bad it is and how high we must fly with our wings not bound by wax, but by the tears of Sophia and the laughter of Mercury. It's bad, but we of the broken places eat nervous breakdowns for breakfast, and no eternity hasn't gone anywhere. You are an eternal champion. And I have contended that Gnosticism is actually the most positive philosophy out there.
I'll just fucking kill myself. I've been so fucking depressed.
Tony?
Sorry, go back to bed.
No, what now?
It's all big nothing.
What is?
Everything's black.
Seriously, it is. Let me quote Jeremy Puma in his book this way. Listen, Gnosis tells you that the world sucks. They really are out to get you. And you don't know jack about anything. Anyone who tells you anything different is trying to get you in bed. Sure, there are benefits to Gnosis too. But if what you're hearing about Gnosis sounds like the work of some enlightened being, or it makes your BS detector start to twitch, or it makes the author look good, you should probably take a step back. And his scholar, Edmund Lupieri, said, "Ears to hear and eyes to see. That is the tragic ability of the Gnostic."
There's only one hell, Princess. The one we live in now.
Sorry if there are meat sacks listening right now that are ass-clenching because they want to stay with the official narrative of the Creator Gods and their Catamites and Karens in the establishment. But I know things are always good when my eyes and ears are open. When I'm awakening. Things are great, actually, when I can sense the hidden sparks everywhere in this broken Sephiroth.
It's not a tumor.
I am eternally grateful for you who keep me company on this journey here in the desert of the real. On this anniversary of sorts. Thank you.
It's better to burn out than to fade away.
We live. We fight. And we die for each other.
As a gift, I'll provide two bonuses that relate to our interview with Monty. One is with Tobias Churton, sharing on the Gnostic leanings of John Lennon. The others with Gary Lachman, who, like Monty, addresses the idea of the bicameral mind and other alternative theories on why humanity is batshit crazy these days. You'll love both bonuses, I say. As a further gift, I will provide the complete interview and bonuses to everyone. I hope you enjoy and appreciate and begin or continue to support. Because the shows will only get weirder and more interesting and always relevant for the rest of the year. I shall continue to inspire you so you may inspire others. And together we teach the world that divine mania, that wild madness Plato talked about, instead of being eaten by the massive mind parasite that is Yaldi Baldi.
Well, it was nice to meet you, God. Thank you for the Grand Canyon, and good luck with the apocalypse. Oh, and by the way, you suck!
Let us do our interview with Monty Oxymoron. Let us into the dark mazes of insanity, and the treasure, hopefully, the rain.
There is a maze in the desert, carved from sand and rock. A vast labyrinth of pathways and corridors, 100 miles long, 1,000 miles wide, full of twists and dead ends. Picture it. A puzzle you walk, and at the end of this maze is a prize just waiting to be discovered. All you have to do is find your way through. Can you see the maze? Its walls and floors, its twists and turns. Good. Because the maze you've created in your mind is itself the maze. There is no desert, no rock or sand. There is only the idea of it. But it's an idea that will come to dominate your every waking and sleeping moment. You're inside the maze now. You cannot escape. Welcome to madness.
This is the AM Byte interview, and with us we have the pleasure of being joined by Monty Oxymoron to discuss his new book, The Cosmic Brain Explodes, and hopefully a lot about music and spirituality, including his band The Damned. Monty, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your time and Gnosis.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Very, very excited to have you on. And with us, too, we've got the Moondog, Vance Saatchi. Vance, how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. I'll be damned if I was going to miss this one.
You're probably damned already since you've gotten into those pesky Gnostics. So.
Oh, yeah. Heretic.
Yeah. But what are you going to do? Well, Monty, I thought before talking about your book, you and I had a small conversation about music and Gnosticism. And I've always been kind of surprised why there's not more any Gnostic themes in popular music, contemporary music, and hoping I've completely like a blind side that I've missed my own ignorance. And I talked about Tori Amos and her album, The Beekeeper, which is directly inspired by the Nag Hammadi Library and Elaine Pagel's The Gnostic Gospels. You mentioned a song by Kate Bush. Do you see any other Gnostic themes in music, in rock music, punk, or anything else that we might have missed or that you can think about?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I think of a lot of the music, the music of Arthur Brown, you know, the God of Hellfire. I'm the God of Hellfire.
Oh, yeah. Band.
A lot of his themes are very, very Blakean in places. I've had conversations with him about this, and indeed he is into William Blake.
Oh, wow.
But certainly he had a band called the Kingdom Come Band, which was after he had the Crazy World, the hit of the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. And they had definitely had some Gnostic themes in there. And also another musician I was privileged to get to know as a friend was David Allen of Gong.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know about Gong, but Gong is an incredible sort of syncretism of mysticism and music, also with surrealist humor and all kinds of other things in there. And I think David Allen also, like William Blake, forged his own mythology so as not to be imprisoned by anyone else's, although it was presented as a very kind of silly mythology, lots of flying teapots and potted pixies and things like that. But the ideas underneath, behind it, were really serious ideas. It was serious, based on Buddhist and Hindu concepts and all kinds of things, Sufism and all sorts of stuff. So I was privileged to get to know David Allen. So I would count David and Arthur Brown as among the Gnostics, certainly. And then thinking about the Damned themselves, I'm thinking of the song "I Just Can't Be Happy Today." Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that, but there's a monologue in the middle of there, which sounds very much like the sort of demiurge, Archon-controlled kind of system. You know, everything's darkness is in power, there's an element there as well. I mean, the dark, what I would call rather than the Gothic, perhaps the dark romanticism of the Damned. There's that element there too.
Isn't there a song, you guys have a song called Antipope?
That's right, yeah. Captain Sensible's brother wrote that. As a result of being brought up Catholic and falling away from that. I don't think it has specifically Gnostic elements, but definitely sort of against the dogma of the established church and the power of the church, of course.
Yeah, I mean, obviously rock and roll and punk and all these movements rebel. They're antinomian. They rebel against normative systems. So you have a little Gnosticism there. And I know in many of the metal bands of Scandinavia, like my friend Anders and his band Draconian, how could I forget? Their music is so wonderful. Definitely go deeper into these Gnostic themes. In rock music, obviously, Jung was a big influence on a lot of musicians. David Bowie, I think, might be the obvious one. He was very much into Carl Jung, and he had devotions to Sophia. He was aware of the Gnostic Gospels. John Lennon, before he died, in his last interview with Playboy magazine, called the Gnostics the true Christians. And you have plenty. Elvis Presley, people don't know, he read the Gospel of Thomas, and he was a theosophist. So it seems to be scattered there. And then you think, then you have to kind of look at other places like Jethro Tull, Bungle in the Jungle, which seems to be a call against the demiurge and how he sets up the system of nature and other things. So it is out there, but it's not, as you might say, prevalent in, as you find it in science fiction and other places, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, someone should write a book about it. I think there's obviously a lot of. I remember some. There was the Gnostic philosophy, the book that he was exploring. Oh God, what's his name?
Tobias Churton. Yes, he's been on the show.
Yeah,
wonderful man.
Just looking at it across, but my eyes are too blurry to see from that distance. But yeah, he was exploring that a little bit. But I think they should be a lot more explored about the richness of the counterculture. I think it tends to be in discussions of, I think we were saying this with my publisher, Andrew, we were saying that it tends to get ignored in these discussions about culture and in general about romanticism, modernism and postmodernism. It doesn't tend to get mentioned that there was this great resurgence of what I would call it romanticism in the counterculture, and it doesn't tend to get recognized or acknowledged, and I think it should be.
Oh, I agree. Again, something to really explore, and I always find it ironic. Obviously, Carl Jung was influential for many musicians in the 60s and 70s. William Blake is always a huge influence on so many artists because of his wonderful poetry, but he is very Gnostic. And I always find it ironic, Monty, that William Blake is considered England's poet. Here in the United States, it's Robert Frost, and both were very influenced by Gnosticism. So it's ironic that it's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, I mean, I must get to know Robert Frost better. He was a favourite of my friend David Allen's. He really rated him, and I don't really know his work. I must explore it more.
Yeah, I wrote an article. I'll send it to you. It's definitely been written by scholars that he was directly. I mean, he has a poem called "The Demiurge's Laughter." So he was very. Very interested in that stuff. And Vance, what about you? Are there any music you consider Gnostic that we've missed?
No, you rattled off so many that I think I'm out of them. I always think of Genesis, though, because like in the Foxtrot album and so forth, where they were heavily into the biblical things, and it wasn't necessarily traditional. There was some sort of overarching eeriness about it. That I always, and of course we have the Carpet Crawlers. You mentioned that all the time. Got to get in to get out. So that's what I think of.
Yeah.
Oh, I can think of another. More recently, there's a band called Secret Chiefs 3. I don't know if you've come across them at all, but they're kind of that circuit around John Zorn and those people.
Oh wow!
In the 90s, and they were a very interesting band. They're definitely quoting stuff from Gnosticism, so they're worth checking out too. Secret Chiefs 3.
Fascinating. Well, it's something we should explore in the future and see if we can find more. But you are right. Tobias Churton does deal with this in his book Gnostic Philosophy. I know he brings in Jimi Hendrix, but I'll have to go reread that passage right now, but it is there. And do you feel the Dem really deal with spirituality in general? I mean, you're also telling me, Monty, you're like, well, I'm releasing this book, which is The Cosmic Brain Explodes, which is a treatise or a Gnostic expression, and your fans might be, you think they might be a little perplexed by it?
Yes, they might well be. I mean, the Damned started out, as you may well know, as one of the first punk bands, the British punk bands, first one to release an album and a single. And back then it was like real high-intensity rock and roll stuff. And I think the first album is a great rock and roll album. But there's no keyboards on there. Obviously, I wouldn't have joined them if they continued in that vein. But the music kind of evolved and changed. And Dave Vanian, the singer, has always been, you know, a gothic figure, always kind of dressed up as Dracula or right. as a, other themes from movies, gothic movies. And so I think that would bring in, to me, my mind would bring in, as I say, the theme of dark romanticism. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. So, I mean, they got the gothic novel and all of that sort of, you know, Frankenstein and all of that from the romantic period, which obviously relates to Gnosticism. I mean, in Blake, the imagery is equally dark and light at the same time, as images of beings of light and beings of darkness. And some of it is very, you know, very demonic in appearance. So, I mean, a lot of the later Dan stuff became more kind of themic, more filmic, more imaginative and gothic in nature. And I suppose that kind of attracts kind of goths to the fold. But my thing, I was always attracted to the psychedelic element in it. I could definitely detect that there was a 60s sort of psychedelic vibe in there to the music. I knew that, you know, Syd Barrett was a big influence on Captain Sensible. And it was that, to me, I suppose, psychedelia. It has a Gnostic element in the sense of a nostalgia, with a G maybe, for out there, for something beyond, you know, something in the echoey music of the early Pink Floyd. It used to take me places. You know, I was very young when I heard that music first. My uncle had a pirate radio station in the 60s, and he played it me when I was a kid. And some of it would just take you up there and out there, whether it was into outer space, literally, you know, in the sense of explored by Sun Ra, another great visionary, or whether it's inner space, you know, a spiritual cosmos, the pleroma, which I mention a lot in the book. I use the word pleroma a lot to refer to that. Just a calling to something beyond, something more, something extra. There's some element of that, I think, in psychedelic music, and there's an element of that in the Damned as well.
No, I would say so too. Yeah, and for the audience, there's also a band I like. I think they're from Northern Ireland, VNV Nation, and they openly admit using Neoplatonism and Hermeticism in their work. So if you have a chance, check it out. And it's interesting too, Monty. I was doing some research on the Damned, and then I sort of went down a rabbit hole. You know how the internet is. You click here, you click there, and suddenly tabs are opening. And I was reading something about the band Killing Joke. And I had no idea that the lead singer, what's his name, Laz? I'm drawing a name. I'm getting today. For some reason, I can't pronounce name. Jazz Coleman. He contends that rock and roll was created by the Tavistock Institute in the early 60s. The big sort of, it's kind of a conspiracy theory here in the United States that the CIA created rock to manipulate the masses and all that. And we have somebody in a famous band actually promoting this. But then I was thinking, like you, I loved Syd Barrett, Pink Floyd, as much as I liked everything else. But then I was thinking, you know, Syd Barrett, even when he came out, he was considered a musical genius, an innovator, somebody who was breaking new ground, who was going places. It was pretty much agreed. And then he had his breakdown, and he was replaced by David Gilmour, who's somebody who's also as much of a musical genius in his own way. And I was thinking, what are the odds that you can do that? I mean, do you ever think about that? It's like something from heaven, or maybe something, or are we going to get conspiracy, something from the CIA laboratories? I mean, what are the odds?
Oh, well, I mean, I hope it's not. There is this sort of current of looking for hidden negative messages in everything. But I think there is that saying, birds of a feather fly together. And I think that bands sometimes do form out of incredible characters. I'm thinking of the Bonzo Dog Band, the people who went into that, and the people in Gong. They were talking about the mix of astrological signs in Gong was incredible. You know, it just sometimes happens like that people attract are attracted or attract each other. And in my case, I was a damn fan, and I was listening to the stuff. And when they brought out an album called Strawberries, it had a lot of organ on it. And I was listening to it, and I think, yeah, that's great. I wish I could have a chance to play with these guys, you know. So I made a natural wish, you know. And, maybe that's what happened. You know, maybe it came back. certainly, I'm sure that wasn't the CIA, you know.
Well, if it was, you wouldn't know, right? Unless they give you a signal and then you go like a Manchurian candidate or something. No, but you're right. I think sometimes manifestation and connection and how the universe draws people together is just as good as a reason. It seems to happen a lot. So
I think that's, I'm kind of exploring that in the book in terms of the way things are put together. So, I mean, we now, from modern science, we know that, unlike the ancient Gnostics, didn't really know what matter was. They talk about it as solid stuff, I guess. So as the lowest vibration, you know, some stuff that pulls you in and holds you there. They didn't know that it was basically, when you look down into it, it's basically space and energy. But I suppose I'm talking also about the way that things are put together, the patterning of things. You know, sometimes there is just a pattern in things. There's that song, "It Ain't What You Do, the Way That You Do It." It's something to do with that, I think, the way things pull together and the great mystery of that. You know, if we could really see into that and understand it, we would understand a lot more about where we are, I think.
Yeah, well said. And self-knowledge and knowledge of the world. And so tell us about the book, The Cosmic Brain Explodes. How did you and Andrew Philip get in touch to publish this really good book?
Oh, okay. That was synchronicitous, I guess. I was, as you know, Andrew produced the Gnostic magazine, which is a fantastic publication, and I was totally addicted to that. So I was reading that, and I saw there was a review in there of about the Damned's old drummer, Rat Scabies, who was in search of the Holy Grail. And he wrote a book about this. I think that the main reason for searching for the Holy Grail was financial rather than anything spiritual. But you know, who am I to say? I don't know. If I see Rat, I can ask him. But anyway, I saw this review, and I wrote into the magazine to Andrew, and I said, "Well, actually, do you know I'm in the same band now?" You know, and we got talking through that, and it turned out that he was a fan of the Damned, amongst a lot of other music as well. And we just got to know each other. Put him on the guest list when he was living in Ireland to come to see us in Dublin, and yeah, we got to know each other that way.
Wonderful. Yeah, Andrew's been on the show many times. He writes excellent Gnostic books. He is a publisher of my two books, Voices of Gnosticism and Other Voices of Gnosticism. So we love what Bardic Press is doing to promote this ancient heresy and all the other subjects that Andrew puts out. And we're looking at you, and maybe we can discuss your journey and how it came to manifest as The Cosmic Brain Explodes. But your book talks about, the first part talks about your ideas and other notions, and then the other part is your Gnostic expression, if you would, which I really enjoyed. It's poetic, it's enthralling, it certainly harkens back to texts like the Secret Book of John or the Gospel of Truth. But one thing that struck out to me, Monty, was you were raised by a spiritual mother and an atheist father, and that is exactly how I was raised. My dad was an atheist, my mother was a devout Catholic, and I think, like you, I said, well, these are fine, and I thought there must be a middle way. Is that how you were too? You said there must be a way that goes in between these two spectrums.
Yes, definitely. Yes, it's complicated. My father, bless him, he was a professor of he studied the history of ideas. So he was studying the history of you know, he would lot about philosophy and about how ideas like Darwinism have affected society and stuff like that. And he wrote a book eventually called The History of Histories, which is was a bit of a big bestseller, is quite well known. But he was always an atheist, and I was always trying to sort of explore further things with him, but he wouldn't have it. You know, he was definitely, no, it's determinist, it's atheist, you know, that's that. But while at the same time being open to all this amazing ideas, you know, from around the world as well. I'm grateful to him in having this appreciation for history and for the ideas and how different ideas interact with one another through history. So that's his world. And then my mother was, like your mother, was a devout Catholic. She used to read me portions from the Latin Mass. She was very much into the Latin Mass, so that I knew what the symbology of that was. And she read me Tolkien as well, as my father introduced me to the world of mythology via Wagner. He's very into Wagner, so the Ring cycle and all the Norse mythology that's steeped in, but also gave me books on Greek mythology as well. So all this was sort of fermenting in my mind. And then when I was a teenager, my mother was actually converted to a more more fundamentalist religious system, a very fundamentalist, literalist interpretation, which was much more involved in the Bible. Because as a Catholic, we didn't really study the Bible. I didn't really know what was in it. I mean, I knew I was interested in, I knew I was interested in the Book of Revelation. I kept dipping into that. I thought, wow, this is interesting. This is wild stuff, you know, Revelation.
It's psychedelic. It's very psychedelic.
You see, Revelation, Ezekiel, Daniel, and those kind of parts, but I didn't know what the Bible was as a whole, so everything kind of became more pulled apart, you know, between my parents, and there was a lot of trouble and a lot of difficulty. It was like two polarized worlds, and trying to find my own way in the middle of that was very difficult. I mean, originally I just went along with my mother and was accepting the teaching that she had, and then as a result of experiences of getting into nursing, I found I couldn't. It was no longer tenable. It was no longer sustainable for me to stay within that. But I didn't want to go completely my father's direction and go into the realms of Richard Dawkins and that lot, and right, say, oh, it's all rubbish, it's all crap, you know, everything spiritual is rubbish, everything in the phenomenal world is exactly as it appears to be, and that sense should be enough for you, enough of this, no fairies at the end of the garden, why not? I like fairies.
Fairies are great.
my friend David saw them. Damn it.
Yeah, he might have been high, but so what? It's real.
Yeah,
that was that certainly was my experience too. And somehow my parents made their marriage work in those days. When did you start becoming interested in other thinkers, or what were some of the influence that would later change your worldview?
Well, I suppose already my uncle was a big influence in playing me all this music when I was very young. So he played me all Pink Floyd and Hendrix and Captain Beefheart and all kinds of stuff. Later we started talking about books and things as well, comic books. We were well into comic books and, imaginative stuff. So he introduced me to the world of H.P. Lovecraft, so it's another mythological creator. Yeah. Albeit very dark, and also the works of Carlos Castaneda was also a big influence on me at that time. I was very interested in that stuff, and I suppose while I was feeling kind of imprisoned in the literalist biblical interpretative world, I started. I think the start off really was the Tao Te Ching. It was Chinese philosophy. Because my mother's paradigm was very much of saying, well, that everything else apart from the Bible is bad and evil and not good and influenced by the dark ones and all of that. And so I was reading the Tao Te Ching. I thought, how can you say this is evil? This isn't evil at all. This is incredible. You know, it's just completely about nature and about the mystery of nature.
Right.
I mean, in a way, opposite to the early Gnostics, in the sense that they tend to see nature as a trap and a prison. Rather, but you know, this was about the mystery of the nature and the power in it and how it works. And I just thought it was wonderful. It started me off exploring things, and then later we've already mentioned Jung, but Jung was my hero as well. When I got into psychiatry, I really got into Jung in a big way.
Well, yeah, and I know your influences are, well, if you bring in Carlos Castañeda, if you bring in William Blake, if you bring in Rumi, I think automatically you're into Gnosticism. Yeah. You've been initiated in some way or another.
Yeah, but also I mentioned in the story at the beginning, the introduction to the book, about I used to visit this woman who had astral travel, and this was back in the time when such things, you know, were not trendy, and you know, he didn't know what this was. You know, perhaps she would have these visionary journeys like Blake would, and would draw amazing pictures of them. She drew a nature spirit that was living in the garden, and she would draw these amazing buildings with lions carved out of a stone filled with honey and stuff like that, you know, amazing stuff. And I used to like going along and talking to her and showing her my pictures, and that sort of intimacy of showing artwork and ideas led to me getting into art therapy later on. Eventually, after a while, my mum said, oh no, you shouldn't go there anymore, they're inspired by dark things. So I didn't go there anymore, and I missed it, you know. And it spoke to me on some level. And I've always envied, I must say, I've always envied people like her, like Blake, like Rumi, like Ibn Arabi, who have this natural capacity to have visionary experiences. You know, they don't have to take anything to induce them. They just like that, you know. Not that I haven't explored, people will probably be surprised by this, but I haven't explored psychedelics very much at all. As I'm saving it up for later. You know, when I'm old, if I get to 80, I'm definitely going to take acid. But it is opening up. I mean, people are talking about serious exploration of these things again, along with all the explorations of the brain that is so amazing now, the technology we can look inside brains and seeing what they're doing while they're alive. I'm very much into neurology, very interested in that. And together with that, hopefully that's opening up a new resurgence in psychedelic therapy and research, which I think could be very useful and beneficial.
Oh, I agree with you 100% here. Some states in the United States now, I think like Virginia and other places, you can use mushroom for therapy. So hopefully it will expand. And yes, I think I was talking to Andrew, and you're very much into left brain and right brain science. Like Ian Mc... I'm terrible with names. The Captain and His Emissary book.
yes. I mean, that's a fascinating book. I definitely think people should read it, because it seems to explain the whole thing of how we reduce the world and get rid of all of the mystery and beauty and everything out of it, because our left hemisphere, which is also where language is mostly situated, and it's the part of the brain that makes maps or images of reality for us. I mean, it's very useful. It's not a bad thing at all, but it needs to be kept in its place. It needs to be balanced by the more broad focused right hemisphere, and the left brain is... The left brain, you could almost say the left brain is the demiurge. Right. I mean, I think that's kind of where I'm getting to in I hadn't actually read that book when I wrote my book, because that was a few years ago I was writing that stuff. But it, some of it, it does sound like a parody of the left hemisphere, the demiurge's world. You know, I am God and this is it and how I make it, you know, because we do, we're not direct. In contact with reality, we are at the mercy of having to make representations in our brains, and so the left hemisphere is very good at codifying and making that into a procedural process, and it's in danger of just getting rid of all the interesting bits, making it too tidy, too technological, yes. I mean, I think technology, very useful, very wonderful thing, but very, again, very left-brained. And we're in danger of imprisoning ourselves in our own creation or our own recreation or representation of the world.
Yeah, the mind-forged manacles of William Blake. Yeah. I think that's it.
Exactly. And... Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Blake would have been on. I had a hate field day about technology.
Yeah, and then you start reading Carl Jung, and of course Jung very influenced by the Gnostics, and you start seeing the ego. The ego's not bad, but the ego disconnected from the source, the pleroma, the wisdom, and all that. That is the demiurge itself. And did you ever start thinking, Monty, when Jung is talking about complexes, ego, and shadows, you start wondering, well, as we human beings, are we just all schizophrenic and have dissociative personality disorders? Do you ever wonder about that?
Well, but Gilchrist suggests, interestingly, that schizophrenia could be created by capitalism. You know, he's saying that it didn't really exist before the Industrial Revolution. People went mad, of course. But the madness was probably more of the kind of bipolar rather than schizophrenic, because schizophrenia is a very dissociative disorder. It's one where, I don't know, best people could be caught in the trap of the left brain and are to the extent that they're unable to relate to other people. I mean, I spent a lot of time I'm a psychiatric nurse myself. I don't think we mentioned that yet. And I was very interested in psychosis and read an awful lot of the literature on the psychotherapy and psychoanalysis of psychoses. And I used to love the business of talking to people and finding meaning in what they were saying, because it's, I think, the worst thing for a psychotic person, as it is for a person with dementia, with the people I work with now, is being cut off from everybody else's reality, because everyone else thinks you're nuts and they can't understand where you're at. So whenever I was talking to these people, I'd be trying to find patterns that I could understand within what they were saying, but also to always thinking to myself, what would it be like to experience this? What would it be like to have these thoughts, these experiences, and for everyone else not to understand, you know, is incredibly isolating. It's like being in a permanent nightmare of your own brain's own creation. So it's really important for people to make space for meaning in people's, when people are talking like that. And especially now, I mean, dementia is so much more common than schizophrenia is. Any of us could get dementia, any of us at all. There are different sorts of dementia, and it's just possible for any of us. So we really want people to
even younger people, 40s, 50s can get dementia.
It can do, yeah, it can happen. So we at that point, we really want people to be on your level as a person, to understand you and the way you experience what it is you're going through. It's what we call person-centered care in nursing, just really understanding the person's perspective, what it's like for them to be cared for, not trying to adapt to them and not to adapt them to us. I mean, for a demented person, who, you know, who wants to be reminded that it's 2021? I mean, for God's sake, you know, if you're living in 1978, yeah, stay there. It's a lot better.
Disco.
Or punk.
Yeah, definitely
or
punk.
Or in the 60s or wherever, you know, if you can support someone to live in whatever space, headspace they're in, let them be there. You know, as long as it's not causing danger for them or other people, there's no problem with it.
Yeah, it reminds me of the story where Carl Jung was treating a lady who believed she lived on the moon, and she would just talk to her, a patient, and she would say, "I live on the moon, I live on the moon." I think Jung's second in command, Maria von Franz, I believe was her name, was like, "Oh, so this woman believes she lives on the moon." And Jung said, "No, no, no. She lives on the moon. That's how we approach it." Because like you said, he was approaching her reality first. And by doing this later on, he was able to cure. She was able to become, you know, lucid.
I had a little glimmer of that working in when I was studying art therapy. I was working as an agency nurse from place to place, and I was in a place where people who had psychosis were, it was like halfway house, it wasn't a hospital. There was a woman there who told me she was dead, and she said to me, "Wow, it's not bad being dead, you know, it's okay, you know." And I said, "Oh, okay. Is there any way of coming back to life?" And her eyes lit up and she said, "Yes, drink water." And she went, "Got herself a drink of water." Which is a lovely little, if you stay with the person, with the imagery, and you take it seriously, it can really, you know, do stuff. It's good.
Yeah, I would say so too. Fascinating. Yeah, and of course, being dead is very Gnostic, right? The being asleep.
Right, yeah,
when the Gnostics say dead, I mean, yeah, you're just asleep.
Yeah, or dead to one thing, open alive to another. Exactly. I mean, on that level, there was a woman with dementia. I think they call it Lewy body dementia. So it's a kind of dementia where you can experience visions, hallucinations, and so on. And she said to me, "I've just seen an angel with eyes of flame."
Wow.
And she is taking me. She is taking me to a birthday funeral.
Wow.
Oh, well, cool. Yeah, I mean, immediately, you know, the death and rebirth thing, you know, incredible. It's very enriching sometimes, that kind of work.
Yeah, and going back a little bit, Monty, why does McIlchrist think that capitalism created schizophrenia? What did it do to reality, or did it fragment us or cut us off from our inner selves?
Well, yeah, I think he's saying the emphasis on the left brain and forcing people to live in the world of the left brain.
Oh, a linear timeline and all that.
Yeah, that's what does it. It cuts you off from the broader focus. And also the right brain is better connected to the emotional centers in the body than the left. So I've also been getting into a thing called embraining recently, which talks about us having a mind not only in our head brain but also in the heart, very, very Sufi kind of that, the heart brain, and the gut as well, the gut brain, and getting reconnected with, you know, it's more part of this bigger sort of embodiment philosophy, which I think is a very positive thing now. So yeah, I've been getting into that too.
Wonderful. And you were talking about the lady you spoke to at the hospital. Is that in your book when you wrote when you were a psychiatric nurse at Graylin? And can't do names today, but this woman bursts into the room and said, "There will be 7 writers who will write a book on the eternal truth, and you are one of them." Is that the lady?
That was what, yes. I mean, I suppose my Sophia is a composite of various women who've there's the one who had the visions I was talking about earlier, and this one who just appeared and disappeared. I mean, I never knew her name or anything, and that just happened. But previous to that, there was a a woman who got how I got into psychiatry was that I was working. I'd been on the dole for a long time during the Thatcher years. You know, there was a lot of people who were unemployed, and we were on a project somewhere working on software. I was supposed to, God, I'd had no idea about computers or anything, but I was the resident artist or maverick, something or other. Anyway, this woman, she came into work one morning with this amazing, this look in her eyes. I couldn't explain what it was. And she said, "I've got till 9:45 to save the universe," she says. "And we should smash all these computers. They're evil." And off she went and disappeared. What was that? What was that about? And at that time, I had no idea what psychiatry was or much about psychology or anything. So I later heard she'd been admitted to a psychiatric hospital. And I thought, I have to visit. I have to go and see her, see if I can help or anything, or just find out what this is about. And so I went to see her, and she was full of all this. She had amazing imagery in her head, you know, totally. She thought she was pregnant by the devil, being raped by the devil with a new Messiah. yeah. And she was obsessed with the joke from Douglas Adams, the meaning of life being 42. She was obsessed with this. And 21 and 21 equals 42. 42 equals question mark. And this resonated with me very much, because when I listened to those Hitchhiker's Guide programs, I was almost pulled into this idea of there being a meaning of life, the universe, and everything as a serious thing. Because there's a part in the book where, or in the series, where a woman, would be sitting in a cafe, and she gets enlightened. She gets the thought of what it would all be. And then, of course, the Earth is destroyed by the right. The Vogons, who are very left-brained beings, wanted to control the universe as a bypass, and that was the end of that. But that joke, you know, that there is it a joke, you know, is there an ultimate meaning to everything, to all of it? I guess that's partly what the book's about. It's exploring, you know, what could it be, what is this?
yeah it's the right question, I guess.
I think I know the answer, believe it or not. I don't know if you've ever heard this. You want to hear it? All right, here it comes. 42. Fortuitous. Fortuitous. In other words, yeah. Douglas is trying to say everything, the meaning is just like things just happen. They're fortuitous.
And, well, Douglas Adams did say something like stuff happens.
It's all just fortuitous.
There is that saying, of course, shit happens as well, which I think of John Bennett and his law of hazard, and he's saying that the whole point of that the meaning of in the universe can only be because things can go wrong. Because if everything was perfect and nothing ever went wrong, nothing would be meaningful. Everything would just go straight on, you know, straight path.
True that.
Yeah, this works, this works, this works, this works, this works forever. And even God, he says, was subject to the law of hazard. It's the only way that the universe can have meaning is because it can go wrong, which is quite a mind-blowing thought, really.
Yeah,
I think it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said.
I hadn't caught of fortuitous. Yeah, that's good. I did discover later that the number 42 was of some significance to the ancient Egyptians.
So, it is, yes.
Maybe it was onto something on another level as well.
Or the CIA did everything. I always blame the CIA or the Archons, Monty. Just that's an easy path out.
they're very popular at the moment. If they, you know, that's the thing. If there is an Illuminati, they've got to be evil. They've got, you know, can't be good guys trying to help everyone out. You know,
no, not in this world. Vince, do you have any questions for Monty?
Yeah, Monty. In your travels as a psychiatric nurse, I was wondering if you'd ever encountered any patients that were mysterious in the way that, in other words, you thought or suspected that they had contact with other realities, I mean, other than just sort of ones that were made up in their head, you know, greater realities or tapped into the unconscious, things that you could, if you listen to them carefully, you could actually learn things. How about that?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, like the one I just met, the one I mentioned with the Louis body dementia, it definitely seemed as if she was onto something there. But I think everybody has this capacity to some extent. I can't say I've come across anybody either as a patient or in general life who I would consider to be enlightened with a big, you know, big capital around it. It just, you know, I haven't met anyone like that. I've met plenty of seekers and plenty of people who have amazing insights into things. But I think it's just like that. It's kind of fleeting. I think I mentioned that in the book as well about how perfection sometimes appears. It's definitely here, but it doesn't last. It appears and disappears, and you have to sort of be aware of it. We've got another example there from my work, a woman who has dementia, who just came up to me one day with a big smile on her face, and she says, "I'm here," just like that.
In the moment.
I mean, that's easy to miss. You could go, she's settled today, you know, put it in the notes, she's settled and happy today, blah, blah. This was more than that. This was a moment of sheer sort of joie de vivre, you know, it's like, it's good to be alive. Which to me is fantastic, you know, for somebody who has lost so much through dementia to experience that and be able to express it is a real window there. You know, I think we always have to look for these windows where things just are just right and remember them when they're gone, you know, as well.
That's really well said, and I love it. Why don't we talk about your book itself? Perhaps you could share with the audience. I'm not going to say you wrote it, but how did it come out of you, Monty?
Well, it's as I described in the introduction, I just had this, after remembering the woman who said there were going to be seven writers writing a book on the internal truth. I thought, well, why don't I give it a go? You know, so I just had a little purple book by the side of the bed, and every time I felt the inclination, I just write all these thoughts and ideas into it. I can't say, you know, I didn't go into a trance or anything like that, as far as I know. You know, unlike, you know, descriptions of that. What's that? I don't know how you pronounce the name of that. There's an incredible book. Is it OASFE, the Cosmon Bible? You know that one?
Yeah. Really? Oh my God. Vince and I went this. We did a show on it, and Vince and I had to ask our guests how to pronounce it many times.
Yes.
Remember Susan Martinez, Vince?
No, I'm drawing a blank. My memory isn't what it used to be. Too many shows. Too much time.
But it wasn't like that. I mean, that's described as, you know, your hand being moved. You know, I was moving my hand, you know, as far as I knew. But the stuff, you know, I deliberately didn't censor anything. I deliberately just let anything come out the way it did. Didn't sort of correct anything or anything, and just left it there by the bed until the next time I felt like writing it. And then I wrote it again. So that went on for a few years. And the book had been around quite a few years when, before I sent it to Andrew. I just sent it. I didn't think in terms of publishing it. I just thought he might be interested. So I sent it to him, and he said, "Oh, I think I'll publish this." Oh, wow. Okay.
Awesome.
So he did rearrange it as he describes. He cut it up into bits because it was just written as is. It had no thematic, it wasn't organized in terms of themes or anything like that. It was just as it came out in time. So he reorganized it into a different form. And the book doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end anyway. It's all like, you know, everything relates to everything else in it. So he did that, and then I came up with some subtitles for themes that helped me. I think it helps make it more readable rather than just a great big splurge of text. And then found that there was the images as well that seemed to go with that So, basically, that's how it was written. And it's been around for a few years now. It's funny coming back to it now after all this time, as I've kind of moved on and gone into all this other stuff. And you know, like I was talking about, the neurology and study of management of people and NLP and embraining and all kinds of things. Oh, and the study of music. I was studying history of music and philosophy of music and music, the brain, all kinds of stuff. Since then, so it's nice to come back to kind of being reminding myself of the Gnostics again.
and the drawings in there are yours?
Yes, they are. Yeah,
I love them. They're very, very powerful stuff. Yeah, your book reminds me again of the Secret Book of John, what they call it, apophatic theology, where you're trying to describe something by not describing them, because you're dealing with obviously something that's ineffable and sublime that is beyond comprehension, but we've experienced in our deepest selves, if you would. And I like how in your this stream you have of consciousness, of tapping into yourself, into your soul, your cosmology, isn't it very much like the Hermetic creation story? I think in Hermeticism, the sun or the nous falls in love with itself, like the myth of Narcissus. But in yours is what? It's consciousness that falls in love with itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to come back to a similar theme over and over again from different angles. I guess it is related to panpsychism and the idea of a cosmic consciousness. You know, if there is a consciousness of the whole universe, what would that be like? Would it be what we would call God, or would it be something different? What relationship would it have to us? There's a lot about how we view it. It might become what we think it is because it allows itself to, or if we allow it to be what it could be, what would it be? Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of echoing back and forth between the cosmic consciousness and our own. I suppose that's really what the cosmic brain is. It's not my brain. It's the brain. It's the cosmic consciousness exploding in with meaning, with the pleroma. I suppose that's what I'm coming back to all the time.
I would say so too. And there's a lot of beautiful lines. Again, I liked it a lot. Certainly was inspiring to me. But here is one quote I took from your book. It goes, God is one, but is also the many. The pleroma is the fullness of manifestations. All thoughts in one thought, each thought in the all. Very nice.
Right. I guess I'm thinking of Indra's net as well there. Right. Yeah, everything reflecting everything else. And also of the Sufi image of the individual being like a drop in the ocean. Again, the ocean is made up of all the small consciousness as one. There's that significance. We don't have to feel we're a tiny bit of nothing in the universe, a little bit like, you know, that was the Douglas Adams thing that, his characters are thrown about all over the place, not knowing what the hell's going on. You know, there's something more. We're meant to be here in some shape or form, even if we can't see it. It's versus right.
This a revelation that came to you at some point, or is something that you reasoned out? How did this come to you?
God, I don't know. It's a theme, I suppose, that when I've been reading things, I guess Hazrat Eniat Khan is another one who, you know, reading some of his stuff. His stuff is very positive and evocative. And then reading about Indra's net, and then was it the Flower Arrangement Sutra? There's a Buddhist scripture like that as well, where you know everything reflects everything else in a positive way, as opposed to the postmodernist business of being stuck in a room full of mirrors where everything signifies as reflecting other signifiers to infinity, and there's no meaning in it.
Right. Yeah, that is true. And you also some other lines too I wanted to share with the audience, because I really enjoyed it. But You write, Gnosis is that unfathomable sea itself. So it is, like you said, it is understanding you are part of this eternal consciousness, but like Indra's net, that everything is interpenetrated and depends on itself, on each other.
Yeah, that's right. Finding meaning. I suppose in a way, I mean, when I got into the Gnostics, I was going a little bit against faith and in wanting knowledge, you know, as experiential knowledge as opposed to belief. Because beliefs are very, we could trap ourselves in beliefs. Once we believe something, we can be trapped in it because our brain interprets everything that we see and hear in accord with the belief that we're holding. But at the same time, I suppose a basic belief in the positivity of being and the positivity of being alive, that it is for something. I think Kate Bush said something like, now I know I'm needed for the symphony. So like an individual note in a piece of music is not going to know why it's there. But in the piece of music, of which it is a part, it makes sense.
No, that makes sense. At the same time, Monty, you do write in your book that your book is really an exploration of what is truth. I mean, and of course, there's that scene that I also always find so powerful when Pontius Pilate asks, what is truth? And he walks away from the one person who can answer that question in the Bible. Yeah. So that was very interesting that you put it in there, and this is what your book is about.
Yeah, it's a deafening silence, that. What is truth?
Oh, I'm out of here.
For 4 minutes 33 of John Cage follows that. And that was that because Jesus didn't know? Was it because he refused to answer because Pontius Pilate wouldn't be able to take it on board? Or was it because the nature of truth itself is in essence silent? You know, it could be, there's so many possibilities within. And I mean, the Bible is full of words. There's a hell of a lot of words, and sometimes you wish they were less often. but that silence, that gap, is a beautiful, like a light hole rather than a black hole in there that allows for possibility, for vision and for further progression.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. There's this quote also in your book, the sacred is hidden, occulted in the profane. The significant is hidden in the mundane. I like that a lot because it reminded me how the Gnostics were always trying to seek a spark, that divine spark in everything.
Yeah, and that's the way of overcoming possibly the dualism that they tended towards, because dualism is for us now a very bad thing. We've inherited this dualism from Descartes and from the Enlightenment, and that has led back to Gilchrist again, to this left-brained situation which we're all trapped, and so it's very bad for us to view the body as unimportant, to view matter as unimportant, to view the environment as unimportant. You know, I think if anything we need to, my partner Kirsty is actually a pagan, and so they venerate nature. They see sacred in nature, and I think that's very important to do that now, because otherwise we're just going to destroy it and get rid of it. So we can't afford to have to escape into a sort of disembodied spiritual space that doesn't connect with the body and with the wisdom of the body and with the wisdom of matter. I mean, what is matter ultimately? It's a description. We don't know ultimately what stuff is, what matter is, why matter is, why it matters. I think it's really, so that thing of the transcendent being hidden in the imminent, you know, split open a piece of wood and lift up a stone and there I am. I see that as very important.
Yeah, that is true, from the old Gospel of Thomas. And in your work, tell us about who is the demi-ego. We all know, but what role does he play?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, maybe we can be the demi-ego a lot of the time. We could blame it all on God, on
of course.
God of the Old Testament, especially at the moment with what's going on in Jerusalem. It is horrendous. You know, just think, my God, why didn't you sort it out? Why didn't you set aside some land for Ishmael as well as Isaac, and, you know, and sort it out? Why couldn't you see that this would happen? You know, that's taking it literally, of course. And the sort of things that God says in the Old Testament, I am a jealous God. Jealousy is not really something we tend to be proud of, you know. It's like saying, I'm insecure. And it's God, insecure? What use, you know, what help is there for us if God is insecure? My God.
My God.
It really stuffed then. Yeah. So on a literal level, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you could even give credence, I would imagine, to these, I enjoy watching these ancient alien programs on TV.
Yeah, they're fun.
And you could think, you think of the demiurge could have been a guy in a flying saucer who created all these sort of happenings and events, and because, I can get worship from these little guys down here. I can get them all to say how great I am, you know. Oh, I enjoy that. you can imagine that on the literal level. But, I do hope that cosmic consciousness is not of that nature. But then that is just a reflection of our own bad nature. You know, that's us when we're crappy and when we're not empathic, when we're not, well, again, like the embraining thing, we're not in contact with the heart mind and the gut mind. We're just stuck in the head mind, or we're just stuck in our own narcissistic image of ourselves and are not open to the bigger picture of things. We can definitely become like a dictator of our own territory. Yeah.
Well, that's always a hard question too at the end of the day, and of course the Gnostics dealt with this, Monty, is again, we start like your text and many of the Gnostic texts, it's a beautiful expansion of consciousness overflowing, this emanation theology that the Gnostics and the Neoplatonists and the Sufis and others had, and it's great. But then the Gnostic says, well, at some point there must have been a breakdown and the ego thought it was the only thing, or the demiurge, or these lower gods. Do you ever wonder how does thing... Or what is your head? Did things go wrong at some point? Or do you think this is just a necessary growth of the divine mind trying to get to know itself? I mean, even Jerusalem and Palestine, or Israel and Palestine, it's all part of it. Or what do you think? It's a hard question, of course. I mean, you might need a towel and number 42 to get you through this.
Yes, nice teddy bear. it is very perplexing and very heartrending. And I guess also, I was talking about with Andrew again about the 60s again, that the 60s there did seem to be this real optimism on the horizon and of a real sense. And I think a sense, particularly music, had a big part to play back then. The feeling that music could transcend human society and people could learn to love each other and be kind to one another and respect the planet and all the rest of it through music. I mean, I think it's no surprise that the hippies used to say peace, you know, to one another, because I mean that's what the Sufi used to do before, and to talk about jam sessions. I mean, jam means gathering, doesn't it, in Sufism? So maybe that's where that comes from. But I think there's a whole ferment of ideas, like there was in the around the first century, interesting stuff circulating, and that there was a positive possibility in all of that in the 60s, but we've lost it now. I don't know where it's gone. It's not here anymore. No. Music is no longer that important to people, is it? I don't know.
No. or it's just crap. I don't know, but you're right. I mean, I think I'm sure you'd agree that the UK is just has become just as schizophrenic as the United States. Like, we're lost in space. Like that Don McLean song, American Pie, we're lost in space.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I was trying to figure out what happened in the 21st century to bring this about. And I can only think that it's something to do with social media. I mean, social media in a way is a wonderful thing because it can connect people who are miles and miles apart in seconds and they can share ideas and so on. But it hasn't had the positive effect that you would imagine. It seems on the opposite. It seems to have made people more insular, more paranoid, more insistent on their ideas and their philosophy. And, oh, yeah, we're the Brexit people. We're the people who aren't into Brexit. Right. We're the Trump people. We're the anti-Trump people. We're the this, we're the that, either this or either that. You know, there's no kind of middle ground anymore. No, what Winnicott would call potential space in the middle where, you know, creation can take place. I don't understand why that's happened. I don't know whether it's the back to the Argonauts again, if they're in charge of it, but it's a pity, whatever.
Yeah, like you said, it's suddenly we're 7 billion little demiurges trying to control our little kingdoms, and nothing's acceptable outside of our line of thinking or our little territories. It's
We can become an Archon and convince other people control our little bubble, and that's all that matters. There's my little bubble with my friends, and everyone else can
agree with me, or I will block you, or leave, or insult you on the comment section, or something like that.
Disapprove of you, upset you.
Yeah. What do you think, Vance? Or are you going to blame it on ABBA or Ace of Base?
I think it was disco that did it.
Disco did it.
Yeah, that was the start of it. But seriously, I think what is happening is because of the situation on the planet and the population's growing and so forth, and our quote unquote progress is growing, we're creating problems at a rate faster than we can solve them, and then everybody starts fighting over the solutions. You know, the capitalists think, oh, more progress, more money, you know, more turning people into, you know, we got to get everybody in the team or whatever, and then we got to replace them with machines. And then you have the extreme opposite where they'll, oh no, we just have to have one overarching government that'll solve all the problems and take it all. And that's the big fight I see, you know, between the machine of progress and the bureaucracy of care, and a lot of what we lost, you know, and back in, because, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 60s and the 70s and the way it was. A lot of that back there wasn't present. And then the internet has accelerated everything. I mean, the speed of communications is a limitation on things, and so we've sped that up, and so the whole thing is just going, you know, headlong. The snowball, the rock of Sisyphus, is rolling down the hill faster and faster. That's my take on it. And you know, the other thing is we don't recognize the realities of consciousness beyond consciousness of the individual. I mean, you know, the collective unconsciousness, the egregores, you know, that's still not something people are aware of. I mean, there are giant forces of intelligence that are acting. They're collective. They're made out of us, you know, and organizations of us through the internet, you know, and then there's a brain, you know, the people that run the planet and so forth. So that's the short answer. That's the way I see it.
I think that's a very good answer. I think I forgot who said it recently or what quote, but an abundance of information is a poverty of attention. And I think we've reached that. And everybody's an expert right now. Everybody's an expert on Middle East politics. And a month ago, everybody's an expert at viruses. So,
yeah, mask or not the mask.
Yeah.
to quote a certain individual, no one knows more about than I do. He was fond of saying that, wasn't he? But yeah, so that reminds me very much of, I suppose, to come back to evolutional psychology, thinking that we still have the same old, you know, physically, we still have the same brain we had way, way back. And it wasn't designed to deal with as much information and change and everything else as we now have. But of course, that doesn't, I mean, that explains that, but it doesn't explain the possible of a spark of inspiration of the light from outside of the Plato's cave coming in and, you know, of being able to face reality directly. So the spiritual reality seems to be becoming more and more buried. And as I say, I suppose another thing is there's a danger of spiritual narcissism as well, of, like you say, becoming an expert. Or no one knows more about Gnostics than I do. The danger of that, because, I mean, as soon as you're an expert, then you can't let any light in anymore.
Right. You've got it. Yeah, you're never learning, never growing.
Yeah.
And do you feel you do deal with this in your book, Monty? Do you think postmodernist thinking might have made things worse? I think you quote the great Ken Wilber, who feels it's created narcissism and nihilism across the world, even if it can be useful.
Well, that's right. It seems to have trapped us, like I said, trapped us in this world of mirrors, mirror space. That was it, Baudrillard, isn't it? Sort of images reflecting other images. And yeah, you have to find a way out of that one. It's just otherwise we do build our own prisons. We can build our own prisons of ideas, like you said before, mind forged manacles. We apply them. We build our own prisons and we stick ourselves in there. Why do we do that? You know, we could build other stuff. We can build venues. You know, like the devils who are thrown down into hell. You know, in Milton, in build a big venue and do a gig in it, you know, pandemonium. You know, if they had a bad situation, you might as well.
Yeah, well, here we are. That's what we're trying to figure out. And in your work, Monty, how does the resurrection take place? You do talk about this.
I think it's in perception. I think it's a resurrection of understanding, rather than the literal thing. I think these, like I was saying, these prisons we create for ourselves can be dissolved, can be dismantled. Maybe this could be a spiritual version of deconstruction. You know, I think that to me would be the resurrection of a new vision of another way of seeing reality, of a new way of seeing relationships and things, and how to live in the here and now, really.
Yeah, definitely an inspirational message. We need this more than ever. And as we start getting towards the end of the interview, Monty, what are some of the Gnostic Gospels that speak to you or that inspire you, or maybe beyond your book you think others should read? I think we talked about the Gospel of Thomas. Any other ones?
Yeah, definitely the Gospel of Thomas. I keep thinking of Thunder Perfect Mind. I really like that. That's so full of anything that's full of paradoxes. I like paradoxes, and I think the paradoxes are a good way out of dogmatism and left brainness. I think I'm very fond of that saying of James Joyce's "Two thinks at a time." To be able to hold two oppositions at the same time, and Jung talked about the reconciliation of opposites as well. So yeah, I mean, God, I'm trying to think of all these texts. There's so many now. I like the Hymn of the Pearl. That's a very beautiful. I mean, that appears again in Sufi literature as well, from the Acts of Thomas, isn't it? That one. But that being reminded of something more, of having come from somewhere better, again like Rumi's the story of the reed being pulled from the reed bed and being made into the flute, and the sad sound it makes reminds it of being in the reed bed. You know, going back again, yeah, the Pleroma, where we belong, where we come from, where we want to return to. any of those sort of those. There's just so much. I mean, that's the thing about now, is that we have so much access to information. Just home in on the good stuff, you know. There's plenty of it, so there isn't really any excuse not to tap into good stuff. You just look for it and find it. Seek and you will find. There it is, you know. Yeah.
Split a piece of wood, lift up the rock, and Jesus will be there. And what about Sophia? I think you said you had a Sophianic encounter while you were doing art therapy. Who is Sophia to you in your personal life?
I think Sophia is a composite figure, just of different women who've inspired me at different times in my life. It always seems to be women, but I always think women have a bigger dimension than blokes do. Tend to be less left brained than blokes tend to be. We tend to be a bit of an obsessive kind of lot. they always bring in an extra element that we hadn't thought of. The animal figure that Jung speaks of. I don't know if we're like that for them. I don't know. I'd have to ask a few. Probably not.
Yeah, that's great. And Vince, do you have any last questions as we wrap things up?
Sorry.
If you have questions, Monty, well, I'll answer your question. Or maybe you want to answer your own questions. Your two brains are starting to work and unify.
Yeah, I was going to ask a little about autism and if you had any experience with that, and if you think what the spiritual implications of autism are.
Yeah, God, that's a big question as well. I mean, some people have speculated whether I might have had autism or might be autistic. Certainly I had the experience, and I suppose of feeling like other people, I couldn't understand other people and they couldn't understand me. It was as if everybody was playing some sort of game and they all knew what the rules were and I didn't. This is when I was younger. And it was really getting into nursing that helped me to really develop sort of understanding of communication and so on. And I mean, music also helps to unify the two sides of the brain as well. It builds the corpus callosum. My nephew has autism. He has Asperger's. So it might well run in our family there. I think the thing about autism is that it's different to someone who's a sociopath. A sociopath has no empathy and doesn't matter to the sociopath, because the sociopath is interested in control and manipulation and so on. Whereas autistic people really do want to connect with people and understand people and to be understood by people. They have a genuine desire for that. And I'm sure that spirituality would play a part in that too. But it's a huge subject that could be explored. You know, it could be a whole book in itself. Autism and spirituality. I don't know if anyone has written that yet.
Yeah, well, thank you. Those are good insights. Thanks.
Yeah, I would agree too. Well, Monty, as we get to the end, for those who want to find out more about you, do you have a personal website, or where can they look for you on the internet?
Yes, so I do have a website run for me by my good friend Henry. So www.montyoxymoron.com. I also have, I'm building up now a Bandcamp, Monty Oxymoron Bandcamp site, which I've just put some stuff on there yesterday, and there's all sorts of music on there. I think I'm aiming to produce the most eclectic Bandcamp site ever. You know, just create from the very sublime and beautiful and spiritual to the absolutely ridiculous and crazy just sort of total nonsense, you know, everything on there. So please have a look at that. I'm also building up stuff on YouTube. I'm sort of playing various things on there, including the bridge up the road. I did a piece based on the playing the railings of the bridge, which had particularly pleasing sound.
Cool.
So yeah, and I have a Facebook page as well. So there's plenty out there for people to look at.
And wonderful. Yeah, you will find him and you will enjoy his content. And I definitely highly recommend The Cosmic Brain Explodes. But we are at the end. First, I'd like to say, Vance, thanks for keeping us company. And I hope you are, well, I hope you're damned, actually, and you go listen to the music.
Very good. I listened a little bit of it on Monty's site. So it was good. And Monty, appreciated being here. Appreciated you sharing your gnosis. Very interesting.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege.
Yes, Monty, thank you very much for coming on AM Byte, giving us your time and sharing your ideas, which were wonderful. And good luck with your book and all your other artistic expressions.
Well, thank you very much.
And there you have it, my beloved True Seekers. The entire interview with Monty Oxymoron for everyone. As a petite celebration for 15 years doing Gnostic podcasting. Cool stuff from Monty. It ain't over, though. Led us to Tobias Churton with some relevant and cool revelations on John Lennon and rock music in general. You write, which I was floored, and you said that a very little-known fact was that John Lennon said that the true Christians were the Gnostics?
Yes.
So he knew about Gnosticism. Whoa.
John Lennon, of course, he would have. I mean, in London in 1967, there was a thing, I think it was called the Free School, and don't quote me on that particular name, but it was like something like the London Free School. And it was around Notting Hill in the area where Pink Floyd were, the Pink Floyd, as they were called then, were playing. Mm-hmm. And if you speak to people who are in that area at that time, people were giving talks on Gnostic religions. It's quite interesting.
Really?
So it was in the air in the mid-60s in London. And, of course, Lennon had also read Sconfield's The Passover Plot, which has some sort of Gnostic shades in it. But I don't know what exactly he'd read. I mean, I know that Yoko Ono was interested in Kabbalistic symbolism at some stage, and his reading, John Lennon's reading in the 60s was highly, you could say, spiritual speculative, was a big interest of his, always had been. Not something he could talk to the teen magazines about, but he'd always had a sort of an eye on that strangeness. I remember having dinner with Bill Harry, who was at college with him in Liverpool, and used to run a paper called Mersey Beat, and he said that the Lennon he knew in Liverpool was interested in anything strange or out of the way of spiritual. You know, they're all interested in what happens when you die and can you speak to the dead, and they were seriously interested in there's more to the human, the dimensions of the human being than is apparent to the eye. I think that was just the feeling they had, and they expressed it in art or just the way they were. I mean, Lennon always said he had this psychedelic vision. He'd had it since he was a child, that he saw through things very quickly and saw through people, tended to have see people's souls and that sort of thing. And, you know, that it was a spiritual vision that he had, but he got sick of it in the sort of about 65 period, and he had a big argument in his own mind with Catholic concepts, which you can hear in those early songs. But the quote you're talking about comes from a book called Skywriting by Word of Mouth, which he wrote in the late 70s and which wasn't published till 1986. And there's a wonderful little chapter in it called The Mysterious Smell of Roses. And he talks about a discussion he had with the childminder, I think it was, Helen, I think. They were talking about spiritual religion, which he was apparently always talking about when given the chance, given the right company. And he then he said the only true Christians were the Gnostics. And then Yoko put a footnote in and he said, well, we know that he wasn't saying that the Dead Sea Scrolls were Gnostic. It was a little footnote about it. But they were aware of the Gnostic tradition. And I think he did an interview with Playboy magazine very shortly before he was murdered. where he talked about this, he said there's always this group that emphasizes the self, and he says there's Sufis, there's the Gnostics. So he was very aware of that. But it wasn't something he was going to go on a bandstand and announce to the world, because he already knew what happened. You know, if you speak publicly in the very broad pop culture sense about these things, you know, every lunatic is immediately ignited by this kind of thought and feels that they're, everything they know is true and good is imperiled, and they, you know, they get hysterical. You know, so he was a quiet thing. I think people who are really into his music could probably feel the presence, even though if it wasn't referred to directly.
Yeah, imagine no heaven or hell. That's right out of Gnostic.
Yeah,
thought.
But of course he didn't mean what but he didn't mean what people think he meant.
Oh,
by
I agree.
So you know, so many of those things that. You know, I'm not sure he was ever very, you know, for all that song. It's so easy to misinterpret that song in two or three ways, I would say, imagine. I think it probably upset him a bit. That's a guess. You know, imagine no heaven, no hell. What was he saying? Was he saying we're better off without religion, or we're better off without a certain kind of religion? You know, it's very difficult to say. What was in his mind that day in 1971? You know. I'd love to have had a chat with him about that.
Oh.
I suspect he'd have got a bit hot under the collar because, the moment you try to write down a mystical insight, to somebody who hasn't had that insight, it reads completely differently to the way you felt it when you wrote it. There's always a great problem with writing. I mean, there are religious Gnostic traditions in the world that will not write, you know, for fear that the writing becomes worshipped and the experience is ignored. Maybe we have too many writings, religious writings. You know, we rely too much on these things. I really wonder what the attitude of the original Gnostics was to their Gospels. Were they sort of throwaway jobs like, oh, well, I came up with this one yesterday. I mean, I wouldn't like to start a church on it, but it seemed true at the time. You know, I don't think they wanted them wrapped in gold and look at these precious words that must last for eternity. They were insights at the time, you know, notes on the way, diary entries.
Snapshots of the soul, and then...
If you like, yeah. You know, there are many more Gnostic Gospels still to be written, never mind discovered.
And there you have it again, my beloved True Seekers. Thank you, Tobias. And now... let us play a clip from Gary Lachman. It's longer and broader as Gary discusses the bicameral mind and other alternative psychologies, all that complement what Monty said and give you some understanding on perhaps how to reverse the terrible fragmentation of the human psyche in the 20th and 21st century. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Indeed, and it does make perfect sense, as you were mentioning about the suppression of Hermes, the suppression of Sophia, the esoteric, that sort of, and David Feidler has written about it, led to Newton, and this is a bit ironic because Newton was an alchemist, and it led to Descartes, and even though Descartes got his ideas in a dream, these two figures really were part of the stream or the architects to give us this left brain world that we're still lingering in, right?
Mm. Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that's one of the, that's one of the ironies, of course, the whole thing about Newton is that, I mean, in many ways, what we revere Newton for and what the work of Newton that more or less, you know, led to the modern world was something that he kind of did on the side in many ways. It was kind of, coincidental to his main concerns, which were alchemy and also, you know, biblical exegesis and trying to understand the secret messages of the Bible and things of that sort, and kind of he actually wrote like predictions, sort of like Nostradamus, and he predicted future events and things of that sort. So I'm not taking away in any way from his very important scientific work in optics and laws of motion and so on. But in a way, it was kind of something that happened in the context of all these other things as well. And as you say, you know, Descartes too. He, you know, Descartes. The story about him is he was one of the ones who tried to make contact with the Rosicrucians when the notices of, you know, the Rosicrucian Brotherhood started to appear in 1614 in Kassel in Germany. And, you know, news of them spread through Europe like wildfire. And Descartes wanted to, you know, meet with them, and he tried, but he couldn't find them as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's all these sort of, you know, strange blends and combinations of the two sorts of things. And yes, you know, as you said, Descartes was given, you know, many ideas in his dream and so on and so on. But there does seem to be a kind of very strong shift at that time, obviously, rejecting this earlier kind of more holistic, image-based, you know, symbolic. I mean, the Hermetic tradition it's much more so poetic, deals with metaphor, as you say, imagery, intuitive, as a, you know, and it also, it treats the world, the universe, as a living being, a sentient being that, you know, one can, you know, commune with, one can have, interact with, as we'd like to say today. Whereas the scientific view, which had to develop this way, it's not evil that it did, it's not bad that it did, we wouldn't be able to be having this conversation if it didn't happen. It's just the thing is that its success is predicated on, as you said, the repression of, you know, the more intuitive, if you look at it as I do in the book, because another philosopher who has sort of historical vision I draw on to sort of tell the narrative is the German Swiss philosopher Jean Gebser, who in the last century, the 20th century, died in the early 70s, that he wrote a fantastic book called The Ever-Present Origin. And without going into too much about it, he has a whole kind of history of consciousness that he sees in terms of what he calls these different structures of consciousness that all emerge from something that he calls origin, which is a kind of, well, it's very difficult to talk about. It's kind of very primal, primary, non-manifest dimension of being. Something like the Gnostic Pleroma, we could say, you know. But these structures emerge, and the sort of narrative, the movement is further and further away from this kind of primal source. And consciousness becomes less and less connected to it and more attenuated until finally, by the time you reach what he calls the mental rational structure, it's completely, you know, separated from its source, and it sees the world as alien, much in the way that the left brain dominated view sees the world, because it's cut itself off from its own kind of interconnection to things, and it sees this world that's completely other, you know, completely outside itself. And again, you have the Cartesian separation between, you know, the thinking being, and the extended being, you know, and you have the whole Cartesian dualism that has plagued, you know, the Western mind ever since. Gebser's whole kind of vision sees this mental rational structure as much in the same way that McGilchrist sees a kind of left brain dominated sort of consciousness. But for Gebser, though, that consciousness is starting to break down. It's starting to kind of disintegrate. It in the modern terms, it came into like full force at precisely this time at the rise of what we call modern science. But it's sort of become overripe by now. And so what the story I'm telling is from, I'm sort of, the narrative of the book begins with laying out these ideas I've just been talking with you now about. And then I have a chapter where I talk about the ancient wisdom in the sense that there's this whole notion that's at the root of practically all of the mystical or esoteric or magical hermetic, you know, traditions in the West, that there was some, you know, primal wisdom, some you know, ancient teaching, ancient knowledge that humanity once possessed, you know, but we've somehow lost. And I'm more or less saying that this in a way is a kind of memory or metaphor or some kind of symbol of this earlier, more right brain kind of consciousness that we had, and we were more connected to things, we were more connected to nature. It's something that in another book I speak of as participatory consciousness, in a book of mine called The Secret History of Consciousness, and there's a lot of parallels in that draw on that. I mean, I'm basically working out the same idea in different ways in different books. But in any case, so that's kind of the beginning. So I look into some ideas. What does this ancient wisdom mean? How can we understand it? What's some examples of it today? And so on and so on. And then after that chapter, I get into the whole actual historical narrative, starting with sort of the ancient Greek mysteries and all that. And you can see along the way, up until the rise of science, the main kind of struggle, let's say, or antagonism or drama, put it that way, is between kind of pagan philosophies in terms of, say, Greek philosophy, Plato, just to give one name to cover all of that, and Christianity, that there's a real struggle there, because that's a very interesting one. I found as I was doing the book. So even though I knew about this, I didn't, you know, one knows it, and then when you sort of go in and you do all the reading and consecutively, you start to really get an idea of it. And this was something that's actually, you know, remarkable, I think, about the Western past, in the sense that there were, you know, quite a few times when it looked like the Hermetic, Platonic, kind of intuitive, whatever you want to call it, tradition would somehow find a way into the main kind of, you know, Christian kind of world, and one wonders how things would have been. So I just basically tell the story in terms of different individuals. So, you know, there's the early, let's say, to the Greek mysteries, and then Pythagoras, and then into Plato, and then later on to the Neoplatonists, and then so on and so on, the whole Hermetic kind of diaspora after the fall of Alexandria, and the movement to the East, and the Arab development. And I devote a good chapter to the sort of Persian Gnostic Platonist philosopher Suhrawardi, who was written about quite a bit by Henri Corbin. He was someone I hadn't had a chance to talk about in other books, so it was interesting. That's another sort of theme that comes up in the book too, this kind of inner journey, the Gnostic voyager, you know, the voyage within. And so you have, you know, this happens in Dante, it happens in Suhrawardi, it happens in Jung later on, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of, obviously it's a big book, there's a lot of stuff going on at this. So there's the main kind of historical narrative and story, and then there's, you know, sort of tributaries. I'm thinking about it myself. It's actually, you know, there's, and without ever once having to resort to any kind of conspiracy theory or anything like that, this is just stuff that's just available, you know, if you kind of just read it. It's not, you don't have to hunt and uncover the truth about anything. It's just there, you know. And again, why does it never go away? You know, at least in my lifetime, you know, a variety of scientists and rationalists have debunked all of this once and for all. And it always raises its, you know, head all the time, and it does so because it's part of us. You know, it's fixed into our physiology, our neural, you know, network. So it's something that we're never going to get rid of. We have to understand it.
Yeah, your book is spanning, and for the reader, again, it's a whole historical journey. There are things that, again, most people should know, like William Blake condemning Newton. There are things most people might not know, like the irony that Newton ended up working for a bank that wanted to prosecute an alchemist, which I read in your book. Yeah. But there's a lot of things that most people might not know about. Mm-hmm. For example, and I found so many things that to me were very interesting. One is about man's relationship with nature, because you say, well, man was more embedded in nature, but you actually argue that's not really the case, and you bring up a gentleman named Petrarch, I believe, who was the first person who actually dug nature.
Well, I mean, in the sense of, I mean, obviously, man was aware of nature, you know, for the longest time, and Petrarch was an Italian poet, probably the most important poet after Dante, and along with being a very famous poet and writing wonderful works of literature, he also was one of the first people to climb a mountain purely to see the view.
This was 1360s,
I believe, and this was something that was unheard of at the time. Now, obviously, people had climbed over hills and mountains for a variety of other things, but to do it just to see the view was considered mad. And many historians see this as the first sign of what became sort of full blown a few centuries later in the Romantics, where nature in the wild becomes something that suddenly seems absolutely tremendously beautiful and awe-inspiring and stupendous, whereas before nature in the wild was something that everyone wanted to get away from. It was the wild. It was living as savages. In the early 18th century, a well-tended garden, a topiary, everything was sort of, neatly humanized in many ways, because if you look at the gardens of Versailles and places like that, it's all very geometric. There's patterns and all that. But with sort of, if you want to place, say Goethe with The Sorrows of Young Werther, which is this, novel of one of the first novels of this kind of unrequited love that basically drives this young man into these ecstasies of both joy and despair, and he feels alienated by society, and he only feels himself out in the wild, out in nature and all that. And obviously before that you have Rousseau, but in a way the nature that we kind of go out of our way to get to now. We spend a lot of money to go to the mountains or into the jungle or something like that. A few centuries ago, that would have just been considered absolutely mad. That was something that wasn't on our radar. And so it's an example of someone who talks about this quite a bit is a wonderful writer and philosopher of language, a fellow named Owen Barfield. And I talk about him in the book. And I've written about him at length in my earlier book, Secret History of Consciousness. And he was a great friend of C.S. Lewis. He was among the crowd that was known as the Inklings in Oxford. Tolkien was another one in there, and Charles Williams and so. But he was also a keen sort of philosopher of literature and poetry and language. And he basically argued that the kind of nature that he doesn't mean, it doesn't mean actually make the rocks and trees and flowers, but the way we see it, the way we understand it, the way it's become symbolic of kind of freedom, a variety of different goods that we now see reflected in it. This is a relatively recent sort of development. I mean, obviously nature was, part of human life for the longest time, obviously if only for, agriculture and food and growing and things of that sort. And obviously the nature gods and all that, but the idea for nature in itself as awe-inspiring, as almost erotic, the kind of sensuous delight in natural settings and scenery that the Romantic poets have is very much like, it's almost like kind of cosmic sex in a certain way to put it in a sensational way. That's one of my themes that I work on in different books, that our consciousness has evolved over time, over history. It's changed. The way an ancient Egyptian sees the world or saw the world is very different than the way we see it. And one of the esoteric thinkers I draw on quite a bit in the book was René Charles de Lubitsch, the maverick Egyptologist and alchemist, who most people probably know of him through Graham Hancock's books, because he's the one who said the Sphinx was, probably 10,000 years old or something like that. And it was, it had marks of water erosion on it. And that let the cat out of the bag for many a book. But Charles de Lubitsch, the way he talked about how ancient Egyptians, how their consciousness was, and he talks about what he calls something called the intelligence of the heart, which again is much more intuitive. It's a much more immediate kind of participatory way of being in the world. It doesn't see the outer world as something completely other and completely discrete and set apart from the inner world. The barrier separating the two is permeable. I relate Schwalo de Lubitsch's ideas about this intelligence of the heart to a more right brain kind of perception. And also I bring in people like the French philosopher Henri Bergson, his ideas about intuition. Again, all these kind of things, these different perspectives on the same sort of phenomena lead me to think that this is, you know, we're talking about something that's real, something that's actual in our experience and has been charted by different people at different times. One reason why we don't really understand, let's say, what the Egyptians were doing is because our perception of the world, our consciousness of the world is very different than theirs. And likewise, people in the Middle Ages, their consciousness would be different. So Petrarch is an example of this new modern kind of consciousness where in a way he's separating himself from the world. In the medieval time, if you look at tapestry, you know, this is the thing for Gebser. Petrarch is sort of the beginning of perspective. And this was the great shift in the Renaissance for perspective, where before, you know, if you painted something, the way you saw the background, it didn't have anything to do with how we actually see it. It had to do with what was important. So even though if a church was far away, it would look bigger in the painting because it was more important. It had more significance, more meaning. And the idea of, you know, trying to accurately represent how we perceive the world wasn't sort of the motive behind the painting. But with the shift from medieval time into the Renaissance, it's as if the tapestry suddenly became, you know, from 2D it becomes 3D in a certain way, and you get this separation from and you get the world seen from a particular point of view, particular perspective, ergo, you know, the rise of perspectivism. And this was a very important point in human history of human consciousness, or Western consciousness, for Gebser, and Petrarch's ascent of Mont Ventoux, which is the mountain in southern France, that now it's very easily accessible. It's, you know, there's you know, lifts and it's on the Tour de France route. But back in the day when Petrarch went up there, you know, he was just considered mad to do it. But when he got to the top, he just saw, you know, like the old Who song, "I could see for miles and miles." He just saw for miles and miles. And this was something that, you know, he wasn't prepared for. He had this kind of huge experience up there. If you ever get a chance, he has a letter that he wrote to his father confessor. Because all the time he's up there, he's saying, you know, I shouldn't be dazzled by the beauties of the world. I should be focused on God and the spirit and all that. But he can't help himself but be captivated by these new perspectives that he sees and these far horizons and all that. And this is the beginning for Gebser of our own modern kind of consciousness, which, you know, sees ourselves as separated, you know, from the world. The world is something out there that we look at. And that's a very left brain, you know, and obviously science and so many other things, you know, come out of that. And it has great value. But as I said, the downside is that it can lead to, you know, this alienation, the sense of existential, you know, angst, being lost in the cosmos. We don't feel rooted in the world anymore. And both Gebser in his way, McGilchrist, say, you know, we're basically at a time when it's palpably obvious that, you know, these two opposite kind of ways of seeing the world need to be, you know, somehow brought together. And that's what the whole Western esoteric tradition in many ways is about.
All right, we're not done yet. One more missive, one more goodbye. To truly end, I'd like to share a tune by the talented and intense and very arcane Orion Swift. The song is "Road to Freedom." And cover your ears if you're a Karen-ass clencher, because it's chock full of gnosis and graphic and lyrics. For more on Orion, please visit OriginOfOrion.com. Awesome tune, and this is the end, my friend, as the door sang, on a small celebration here in the desert of the real.
Yeah, I've noticed. there's something going on in the streets. Nobody seems to want to talk about it. So let's talk about it. Out to anyone who's down in the luck.
Real talk, condos in the city aren't being bought up by the 1%. Empty they sit, cause fellow gods and goddesses are forced from their homes, living paycheck to paycheck. Take a step back, look at the city streets. Notice how many of us live in tech communities. While you're ringing red, scoffs as you walk past. More and more displays, cause they can't pay the rent. I give my heart. Swift, Saturnboard, Capricorn, I'm the tax man and I've come to collect, but you got more important things to do like staring at your screens. A man's wife's ride on a pretty little thing. She passes on him, getting a dopamine hit, addicted to the feeling. He's just another notch on her self-esteem count. Everything I know now I learned from my dad selling tickets to our shows on the Emerald City streets. All you need to know now is I'm the next big thing with my unique sound. But for now I sell my blood.